What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper and I'm joined by, and this week I'm joined by...
Matt Tite. Just this week?
I'm just kidding.
Oh, I see. Okay. That's awkward. Right. Awkward.
Awkward, ox. All right. You know what? You do it to me now and be like, and for the first and last time ever,
and introducing.
We can balance it out.
Hi, I'm Matt Taibbi and welcome to Useful Idiots. And I'm joined this week by
Katie Halper. And I'm Katie Halper. And you may know me for discovering Matt Taibbi back in the day when he was just a little basketball player in Mongolia. And I said, this guy has the chops to write.
Right. Right. That's exactly how it happened.
Yeah.
Yep.
I was very young, but very precocious.
Right. Right.
When did you write your first article?
Probably in 1988.
So I was a 7-year-old scout.
Right. You saw right away the potential in that town meeting or whatever it was that I covered
in
Bedford, Massachusetts. Or, yeah. Some silly thing like that. So, yeah. So here we are years later after that important crosswords moment in both of our careers, and decades later, and we're in the middle of the spring/summer of 2021, and all kinds of stuff is happening.
I think we can go full-fledged. I appreciate your caution. I've always appreciated that about you, your restraint, but I think we can say it's summer.
So Katie, before we get to any of the other stuff, we just got to get this out of the way. What's your take on the NBA final? Who's going to win? Let's just start with the basics. Who's going to win?
I mean, if I'm choosing between
the
Phoenix?
Yeah, between the Phoenix Surprise and the Milwaukee Elk.
Yeah, if I'm choosing between the Phoenix Surprise and the Milwaukee Elk, I call them the Milwaukees.
The Milwaukees, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to go with the Surprise.
Yeah.
Because
it's a surprise,
it's
right?
It's a surprise.
Right.
I mean, that's always... I mean, also the skill that they bring to the game. They are so good at... They never travel.
Right. Yes.
Which is so important.
Or at least infrequently enough that they can
they
score.
They travel the games, right. But they don't do that thing you can't do on the court.
Right.
Which is taking how many steps? Three.
Three is too many. Yes, that's right.
One, two.
Well, yeah, it's basically two steps. Yeah.
Two steps. Yeah.
Right.
I give them, I mean, I'm a non-traditional basketball student. Mm-hmm. I started late in life and also my rules are untraditional. So much like actually we're going to get to later in the show, Robin DiAngelo was a non-traditional student. Because she went to school later, but
to be fair, the NBA players have their own interpretation of traveling rules too. So,
well, I mean, that's what I was about to get to before you rudely interrupted and mansplained to me something I totally understand and actually have put a lot of thought into, the very rich history of discourse around what is wither travel.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there's a whole rich exchange about what does traveling mean, who gets to travel,
how far. How do you think Phoenix should approach covering Giannis? Do you think they should double him or sag off him?
Double sag.
No, what's your strategy seriously for that kind of player with those unique physical attributes? Giannis?
Well, Giannis, of course, he's Greek.
He is Greek, yes. Wow.
Which he comes from a long line of, I think actually he should be thrown out of the league because they have an upper leg. No, what's the expression? A leg up. They have an upper hand.
Upper leg. I like that.
He has a leg. The upper hand, the leg up. Yeah, he has a hand up or the upper leg on this because he comes from a very, like they started the Olympics, Matt. The Greeks. So I kind of find it a little bit troubling that it's almost like steroids. Like, you're not allowed to do steroids if you're an athlete. And I think that
you shouldn't be allowed to be Greek either.
Yeah. Or at least there needs to be some kind of, maybe you have to share some tips from your people and your culture.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You have a little cultural sharing before the game starts.
Right. So he, as a Greek, you asked about, I mean, you didn't ask as a Greek, but you did ask me about how you deal with someone with his features, right? That's how you put it, right?
His unique physical attributes. His
unique physical attributes. Yeah. So I look, having a unibrow makes it very hard for you to be able to see what's happening.
He's not that kind of Greek, actually.
What kind of Greek is he?
Well, one without a unibrow.
Oh, he's a duo brow? I got to see a photo of him. See how, is he a self-loathing Greek who gets rid of his unibrow?
I wouldn't say that he's self-loathing. I think he's pretty psyched to be whoever he is.
Right.
Actually.
Well, besides you know what? I actually am working on a piece, a straight to camera video explainer about the unibrow. So I'm going to table that. Why don't you ask me, because he has so many unique features. Why don't you throw a feature at me? Or else we'll be here all day, because I know him and his body, you know, his features so well. So.
Well, he's 7 feet tall and has the skills of a guard. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, let's put it that way.
So he's not a traditional big man, but he's got traditional big man size.
Big man energy. Big guard energy. Yeah. Right. So what makes it complicated is that when you are 7 feet, but a guard, you are at a crossroads. You don't know yourself well. Because you're made to be, it's like God, the gods, Mount Olympus, they wanted you to be not a guard, but rather a forward.
Or a center, yeah.
Or a center. Really, at the end of the day, it comes, I mean, there's a whole debate about that. I don't know if you're aware of that.
About position fluidity, like.
Yeah, exactly. PF, we call it. So there's a whole debate. And I think that what you do is is Scottie Pippen still with us?
Not playing, yeah.
But with us.
Mm-hmm.
He's short, right?
Not really, no.
Was he something, or did I just think that because his name sounds short?
He was about 6'7", maybe.
Is Mookie Wilson a basketball player?
No, he's a baseball player.
Okay. Who is a small basketball player?
You're thinking of probably Mookie Blaylock or Muggsy Bogues, maybe?
Muggsy Bogues. Yeah. So you take a Muggsy, you put him on top of Giannis.
Mm.
And now you have a normal size, normal heighted guard.
Right. Yes. Or no, actually you'd have somebody who's almost 12 feet tall at that point. I think actually it goes the other way.
Right. Okay. Yeah. A little.
Anyway, you think Phoenix is going to win?
The surprise. Yeah. What do you think?
I'm going to go with Phoenix too. Yeah, among other things, because they won the first game before this discussion happened.
I mean, Tuesday night was incredible.
Right. It was
incredible. I thought
it was so amazing. You didn't even.
I couldn't watch. I forgot it. That's how it was like. I have. It's like a repressed memory. That's how amazing it was.
How long do you think the series will go? How many games?
Like 12.
Well, it's the first of four wins. So.
Yeah, but I mean, there's going to be, what I think is going to happen, there's going to be a lot of ties.
Right. Okay.
Matt, we live in this is a post-COVID world.
Right.
We don't know how things are going to turn out.
Right.
So what's your prediction?
I'm going to go with Phoenix in six.
I thought you just said four.
Phoenix has to win four games, but it could take as many as seven to get there.
Oh, it couldn't take 12.
It couldn't take 12.
Remind me, why not?
By the seventh game, somebody will have won.
Got it. Right.
Four
okay.
games.
I was just making sure that you were Matt. Yeah, yeah, you're getting older.
Yeah, I know.
I'm getting older too. Mm-hmm. Landslide.
Well, I wasn't going to say anything.
Predict a landslide.
So Katie says Phoenix surprise in 12. I say Phoenix in six.
It's such a sign of sexism that I'm not asked more about this on the different appearances that I do.
Look, you know, people could be learning from you constantly about this stuff. And they're just not availing themselves of that opportunity. Yeah,
they're depriving themselves.
So do we have anything else we need to take care of before we get to the food groups here quick?
Let's see. I mean, we have some good news coming from the White House, which is that they are giving temporary status to Yemeni people. Biden admin extends temporary protected status for Yemenis. Reading at Democracy Now! In immigration news, the Biden administration has extended temporary protected status, or TPS, to Yemeni nationals already in the U.S., citing the ongoing conflict and humanitarian crisis in their home country, where the U.N. estimates some 20 million people, many of them children, now rely on aid. TPS will be extended for roughly 1,700 Yemenis through early March 2023. The current term was set to expire in September. I want to bring that up because we like to talk about the useful idiots bump, and I think we all know why this happened.
Because we wanted to hire a short Yemeni people?
Short, chubby Yemeni kid, yeah. But right. I mean, like, look, obviously that doesn't change anything. It's we raised awareness about this. And like Biden, the administration knew that they couldn't. It was a big enough story, our demand for a Yemeni co-host, along with Bashar Assad. Those were big enough in the media, like atmosphere, in the media culture. Such
it was
story.
In the ether, so they
in the ether
they,
that right, right, it was in the ether, and so Biden just knew. I think that they knew that they, you know, this is how we push them
they,
left.
They realized that we had the upper leg in this discussion.
We had the upper leg, yeah, and they had the chubby middle
teeth, yeah,
teeth, mm-hmm. chubby teeth.
Well, the toothy chubby. The whole point was that you didn't want a chubby Yemeni kid who would bite.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. I've never seen chubby teeth, though. That sounds like a spoken word. Anyway, you're welcome to the fewer than 2,000. That's kind of a low number.
It is kind of a low number. And you know what? It's indicative of the kind of sort of overall not terribly impressiveness of the Biden White House. Because they had another story this week that kind of ties in with that. That was, we might as well just get to it. This is the Democrats.
They send 80 vials somewhere. He didn't tell them to go back, though. This is huge. Remember, he did tell Haitians to go back. Kamala told Guatemalans to go back. Do not
or
come.
Or don't come.
Do not come. Right. Sorry. That's what it was. Do not come. So this is pretty radical for them. Okay.
Right. Anyway. So anyway, there was a story that came out this week. This is Democrats suck, four foot groups. This is Joe Biden at a debate last year. And this is what he said when asked about the Saudi regime and how he would respond differently than Donald Trump would in the wake of the death of Jamal Khashoggi.
Mr. Vice President, the CIA has concluded that the leader of Saudi Arabia directed the murder of U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The State Department also says the Saudi government is responsible for executing nonviolent offenders and for torture. President Trump has not punished senior Saudi leaders. Would you?
Yes, and I said it at the time. Khashoggi was, in fact, murdered and dismembered, and I believe in the order of the Crown Prince. And I would make it very clear, we were not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them.
I thought he was saying in that order.
We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are.
We're going to make them pay. We're going to make them the pariah that they are. And Khashoggi was murdered and dismembered in that order. If you dismembered somebody and then murdered them, that would be confusing. So, okay. So he's going to shun them. He's going to make them the pariahs they are. All that
he
stuff.
He said in the order, right? But he meant on the order.
Yeah, on the order. I'm kidding. Right. I'm making a joke.
No, I know you are. But it was funny because when I heard it too, he goes, I believe on the order of the Crown Prince. I thought he was saying, I believe in the order. Like it sounded like he was saying like he believes in their kingdom or something.
And I believe in the order of the Crown Prince.
So, okay. So he said all that stuff, you know, with this typical I'm a tough guy thing. And then this week we get this story. Okay, headline, White House quietly hosts brother of Mohammed bin Salman. Top U.S. officials hosted the brother of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman Tuesday. The Biden administration had not publicly announced the visit by Deputy Defense Minister Prince Khalid bin Salman amid ongoing pressure to reevaluate the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. An intelligence report released in February found that Mohammed bin Salman directly approved the assassination of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters Tuesday the U.S. was reaffirming its commitment to the nation's, quote, longstanding partnership and Saudi defense. Just quickly about that, you know, in the debate, you know, the question was the CIA concluded this, and then we have an intelligence report that concludes that bin Salman was, you know, approved the assassination. I actually don't disbelieve that in this case, but is that a thing now that we just have to live with, that now the intelligence agencies are just going to tell us what happened and that's going to become journalistic fact right. from now on?
Right. It's funny. I mean, I almost feel like the way we should believe it, I hear what you're saying, and we've discussed this on the show, that like probably journalists should not be the stenographers of the intelligence community. But it is funny in this case because it's not in their best interest, right? So that's why I kind of believe it. Like right. the administration has no skin in the game in this case, so I'm going to think that it probably is true.
Right. Yeah.
But that's incident. That's kind of doesn't really speak to the larger practice. I mean, how much has that shifted, Matt? Like, as someone who's been, you know, you were around wearing the fedora and
right, yeah, you know. back in the old black and white days,
Like, but how has that shifted? I mean, in terms of how much the press, the media, actually just says uncritically repeats what the intelligence.
I don't know. You know what? I mean, they successfully blotted out my. I mean, I think when, you know, when it was anything controversial, there was at least some perfunctory digging that would be done. You know, if they told us something like, yeah, Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, they would at least pretend to try to confirm it, I think.
Did they with that?
They did. Yeah, they went through the motions. You know, they accepted all kinds of terrible evidence for it. But they went through the motions. They, you know, there were stories. The New York Times did all those stories about suggested that Mohammed Atta had met with Iraqis in Prague. That turned out to be not true. But, you know, they were trying to make the links, at least, that there was a reason why we were going in. But now it's just, it feels like it's a commonplace feature of foreign policy stories. The CIA says this or the NSA says that. And therefore, it's a fact.
There we go.
It's three dots, you know.
Right.
Anyway, but it's
that was fun, yeah.
In this case, it's just ridiculous because, you know, it's just another example of the Biden administration just not being what they claim to be. And also, again, not to belabor this point, but can you imagine if this was Trump?
Oh, yeah.
And he had this dude in the White House quietly, like we'd never hear anything else. You know, they would talk about how he had the blood of journalists on his hands and all that stuff. Right.
And so, you know what? This is I'm with Trump on this one because he owned it. Remember, they asked him if he was going to do anything about it. He said no.
Right.
Because they had bought a bunch of weapons.
Yeah, and the relationship is more important and all that stuff. That's the thing about Trump is there's this awkward thing with him. And we talked about this last week with Austin Smith, where it's just, you can't tell whether the things they're like some of the people in the media are objecting to are the fact that he's saying terrible things or that he's just
taking the mask off.
Yeah. He doesn't recognize that he's supposed to lie about it. Right. So he just says stuff.
I think he recognizes he's supposed to lie about
sometimes.
It. I think he just recognizes that he won the presidency in large part by not lying about it. I mean, he lies about a lot. But I think he strategically, or maybe not strategically, but he's also he just doesn't give a fuck about certain things.
Yeah, like I don't think he knows the difference between torture and enhanced interrogation. Now, there isn't one.
Right.
Right. But he, I think from Trump's point of view, if you asked him why didn't you pro torture? Yeah, of course. But why didn't you say enhanced interrogation? He would like look back at you and draw a blank. Like, what do you mean?
Right.
I did. I said torture, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And he would just double down, right? Like, these are bad guys.
Right.
These are bad,
we should
very
be torturing
bad guys.
Them more. Yeah.
We should be torturing them more. Yeah. Right. That's why it's like, I mean, in the case of the, we're not going to do anything because they buy a lot of weapons from us. That's one of the examples of the, who said it, Trump or Chomsky, where
right.
they're just saying, they're revealing a reality about U.S. foreign policy. It's just that one of them is saying it in a way that is condemning it. And one of them is saying it in a neutral to celebratory way.
Right. Like I'm not sure which I prefer. The one that isn't like, just isn't embarrassed by the fact that we're ignoring human rights considerations in favor of the strategic, the supposed
or alleged,
strategic.
Right.
The strategic considerations. Or the one that pretends to have human rights considerations and then quietly meets with these people.
I gotta say, like, okay, I think you can easily argue that the net, I don't know though. I mean, as of now, yes, the net death and destruction and human rights abuses, I think, under Biden. Would we say that they're lower?
I think it's too early to tell.
Right. So I think that you could let's say they are lower, though. Right. I still think that so if they're lower, you could say it's the net positive, but there's something dangerous. Why did I just say it like that?
I don't know.
Something dangerous.
Trying to be dramatic.
Yeah. But there's something dangerous. There's something refreshing about this. Sounds like a cliched point, but there is something dangerous about Biden covering it up, because then you're not we're not as vigilant, right? We're back to brunching. Lots of people think that, for instance, we're no longer supporting the Saudis in Yemen, but we are. We're just doing it in a defensive way. And of course, the word defensive is even more meaningless than it was before this second round of bombing.
We're doing it in the context of having said that we're going to reevaluate doing it.
Yeah, and also we said that, like, the strikes that we ordered against Iraq and Syria like 2 weeks ago that nobody's talking about, that was allegedly in self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
So again, like, so they
it's
are,
always
we are
in
now
self-defense.
It's always in self-defense. So we're now supporting Saudi Arabia's defensive war. You know, poor, right. Saudi Arabia defending themselves against Yemen.
We were joking, but they're literally defending themselves against the Yemeni kids who are biting them.
Right, exactly, yeah.
In the upper leg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or lower, or in the knee.
Or in the knee, right. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, that happened. Democrats suck. What do we have for Republican suck?
So for Republican suck, we have an interesting flip-flop with a friend of the show. Just kidding. I don't even think we've mentioned him. The author of Hillbilly Elegy, J.D. Vance. Have you read him?
No, I haven't. I never read that book.
So he has, he's running for office, and he is a Senate candidate. And now he has to embarrassingly apologize. This is such a funny move. He's apologizing for anti-Trump tweets.
Mm.
He has come forward now. I guess there were tweets of his.
This is awesome. So now this is happening on both sides. This is great.
Yeah.
I love it.
So reading at the Guardian, the Hillbilly Elegy author turned Republican Senate candidate J.D. Vance has apologized for a former political position, critic of Donald Trump. Like a lot of people, I criticized Trump back in 2016, Vance told Fox News on Monday. And I asked folks not to judge me based on what I said in 2016, because I've been very open that I did say those critical things and I regret them, and I regret being wrong about the guy.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Have some backbone. What's
wrong with
you? I know.
Have some decency.
Well, not even decency. Backbone, at least.
Backbone. You're right. Yeah, you're right. I don't actually think this guy is particularly decent. But he had. But yeah, you could just own it. Be Trumpier about it. You know, that's the way he could be. If he wants to appeal to Trump voters, ironically,
yeah,
he could be Trumpier and just double down on it.
Yeah, I didn't say that stuff.
I didn't say that stuff. Or so what if I said that stuff? Yeah, he wasn't aggressive enough. He was a coward. Yeah.
That wasn't what I meant. Those were just words that I was saying.
Yeah, he should pretend it was a parody.
That was my favorite Trump thing ever. This is such a negative tendency on the sort of blue side of the aisle. This, oh my God, I said something that was once, you know, slightly politically incorrect or whatever it is. Right. And now I'm going to throw myself at the mercy of everybody and apologize for what I said, which incidentally won't work. And so you'll have thrown away your dignity and gone against your original beliefs or whatever it was in vain. And the Republicans heavily criticized this whole thing for years, right? Like this, because they see that as cancel culture and mob rule and all that. Now they're going to do it?
You got to do it weak. Because you got to pay homage to Donald Trump. By doing that's something ridiculous. That Donald Trump, makes fun of. But, you know, it's kind of funny. One of the things that he said to a journalist about Trump is the reason ultimately that I'm not a Trump voter is because I think that Trump is the most raw expression of a massive finger pointed at other people, which is just a kind of great phrase. Raw expression of a massive finger pointed at other people. What do we call that? A mixed metaphor, kind of Seamus Heaney style?
Yeah, like a raw
expression of a massive finger. So he's saying pointing at other people. So he's basically, what he's saying content wise is that Trump scapegoats people. But the raw expression of a massive finger.
Yeah, that doesn't feel like it really flows all that well.
Yeah.
Like he probably means something else.
He's a poet.
So this is going to be, so I actually, I'm kind of looking forward to, well, I could, maybe I should look forward to it. What Republican cancel culture will look like.
Right.
I mean, they've already started it. I mean, the, as much as I'm not a fan of CRT and all that stuff, the, these anti-CRT laws and everything are, it's everything they say that they're against.
But, yeah, of course. Right. Critical race theory for the.
Yeah. Anyway, well, that's gross.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Yeah. Just have a backbone, as you said, have a backbone.
Right.
H-A-B.
As your favorite sportscaster, Jim Rome, used to say, have a take and don't suck.
Yeah. Have a take and don't suck. Right. Right. Exactly.
So what do we have for, isn't that weird?
You got this.
Yes, I do. This is, it's mainly just a picture with a headline. It's from the Washington Post. This weight loss device locks your jaw nearly shut. Experts say that's dangerous and barbaric. I love the low techness of this. You know, like we live in this age when you have pharmaceuticals that can fix basically any problem, like at the neurological level. Instead, they're just basically clamping your mouth shut to deal with eating.
It's very old school.
The story goes like this. Researchers in New Zealand and the United Kingdom said they were fighting the obesity epidemic by locking people's jaws 2 millimeters from shut via a magnetic contraption installed in the mouth. The goal is to restrict wearers to a liquid-only diet. The device has an emergency key to unlock it, just in case users have a panic attack or choke. It's a non-invasive, reversible, economical and attractive alternative to surgical procedures, the study's lead researcher said in a news release Monday. The fact is, there are no adverse consequences with this device. Experts who study nutrition and eating disorders disagree. Deanne Jade, founder and principal of the UK's National Center for Eating Disorders, said the device is like, quote, a return to the dark ages. This is very, very dangerous. Any extreme weight loss device, any of these strategies run the risk of harm unless you're working with someone who is fully trained to deal with all these issues that can arise from it. Blah, blah, blah. It's, other people are saying it's barbaric, incredibly concerning. First of all, what do you think of this?
Well, I like it because it has a kind of like a grill look to it, you know, like the silver thing on the teeth.
Oh,
like the,
so
the
it's
lock.
Like, right. It can be like a fashion accessory too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They call it, the researchers call it, by the way, the world first weight loss device. I don't know what that means. World first. Does that mean like premier or something good about it? It just, there's something weird and ESL-ish about it. But what if you lose the key and you're choking?
Yeah, I think if you're choking and you got this thing on, even if you have a key, it's not going to go fast enough.
I mean, I'm torn. There's something appealing about not having to make any decisions.
I just want this model in my house somewhere.
I just want it at least as a display of art. It's like a chastity belt for your mouth.
Right. I bet if I put this on the floor, it would confuse my dog to the point of, like, she'd back up from that.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. So it's scary enough to scare off a dog is what you're saying.
Yeah. Don't you think?
I don't know. My Bodhi has a real Napoleon complex to her. So she may go after it with the ferocity that is very self-destructive. But yeah, I think you're right. I think most animals would pick up that this is a, see, Bodhi is such a martyr that she may want to protect us from it and attack it. She's not a coward like Coco.
Right. Yeah. My dog's a coward. So yeah, it's funny. I looked for the original story about this, but there's a line in this Washington Post thing about how the goal of this thing is to get people to lose weight by restricting people to a liquid diet.
Right.
There actually was a football player, quite a famous guy named Nate Newton, who played for the Dallas Cowboys. Large man. Dude just loved to eat. He was a lineman. He got up over 400 pounds after he retired. Had a few weed issues, too. There were a few run-ins.
Oh, the munchies.
He was transporting trash bags full of weed. But, you know, people need hobbies.
That's
after
good
they
exercise, I would think, but not heavy enough, not transporting them fast enough or frequently enough.
So I can't find the story, but I know that I'm going to like stake my career on the fact that I'm not misremembering this. He once talked about this idea that he had to lose weight where he was going to wire his mouth shut. he was ready to do it, except that he realized that if he did that, all he would end up doing was liquefying French fries and getting around and like beating his own system.
Right. Well, that's interesting because I have a family friend who, I don't remember why she had to wire her jaw shut. She had, I think she broke her jaw. It was not to lose weight. And she has like five kids. Her kids are now adult, but this is when they were kids, younger, and she was feeding them and stuff. And all she would do is she would take whatever she cooked for them, like hamburgers, fries, you know, spaghetti and meatballs. She would serve them and then she would make it a shake for herself and sip it through a straw. And she said she did indeed lose a lot of weight because I guess you get fuller on liquid and maybe it tastes disgusting to be drinking a hamburger or spaghetti meatballs. I don't think I would do that with fries though. Like, see, it's different when you're doing that really because you choose. Yeah, but isn't part of the beauty of fries that you enjoy, like the texture and chomping on them? I can't imagine liquid fries.
I think if you had enough of a thing for fries, you'd go there.
I'm trying to think of something I really like. What's one of your favorite foods?
Ice cream.
Okay, but that's, yeah, of course, that's just a milkshake. Yeah, but that is a danger. If I did that, I feel like I'd be at risk of ice cream and wine and sangria.
Right, yeah.
What else? I'm not a big soda drinker, but I would probably, if I had that thing done, what were the ways I would cheat? Hopefully I'd be committed enough, you know, if I'm putting a lockjaw thing on myself. Hopefully I wouldn't be cheating, but if we were to cheat, what are some of the things you would cheat on? Definitely a milkshake.
Cake. I don't know. Yeah, anything. Cake. I mean, I think if I was going to take the step of wiring my mouth shut, I mean, I might as well just lock myself in a room or put a bucket over my head. Like if you're going to go to that extreme,
right?
You know what I mean? Go to the next step.
Yes. I'm just curious about what the things that what's that guy's name? The full figure?
Nate Newton.
I'm just curious what my Nate Newton what my weakness would be. Definitely milkshake. Right. Definitely sangria. Margaritas, maybe, but very slowly. The good thing about it is you got to be slow. What about, like, I love pasta. I don't know if I'd sip on. If you could get it really small, how much are you allowed to open your mouth on this one?
Like a half an inch, maybe.
Oh, then I would just be sucking up down like little noodles and pesto linguine.
Right, yeah.
Angel hair. You got to go with angel hair.
Angel hair, but you'd probably be choking it up and throwing it up through your nose and stuff.
But I don't think I would blend angel hair and pesto, which I think is one of the best dishes, or like pizza. I love pizza or sushi. I don't think I would blend it up. So I think
I would blend it up.
Really?
I would have like a pizza shake.
That's so gross.
Anyway. It's a great picture. I mean, I'm really glad that the Washington Post did that. It's like, it's kind of a freaky looking picture. It looks like one of those 1895 news stories.
Yeah. And it also looks like one of those things you wind up and it starts going off on its own.
Every person with a bad sense of humor has at least six of those in their house.
They're not dying.
The chattering teeth. It's just
the
like,
yeah.
There's some people, and look, I admit I'm one of them. You can't go into a Spencer gift store and not buy chattering teeth.
That's funny. That's your Nate Newton.
Yeah.
That's exactly. Your weak spot. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So what happened?
Isn't that terrible? We have a friend of the show, Mark Zuckerberg, who made a lot of headlines by posting a video, sharing a video of himself on a foil surfboard. Do you know what these things are?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, if we could just watch the video, this is something Mark Zuckerberg posted with Happy July 4th.
West Virginia. Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River. Life is old there, older than the trees.
Look, he's trying to get the pose right.
Yeah. Look at that.
Like a breeze, jumping. Country roads.
What is he doing? He looks like an eagle trying to take off unsuccessfully.
You know what's great?
Like, what?
Hopefully. I guess my question is like, how much money do you have before people stop telling you that things are a bad idea?
Oh, that's a good question. Like, where are his no men? Like, he's surrounded by yes men. Yeah, I do want to know that. Like, what was the thought process, do you think, when he did that?
I think he's trying to show his appreciation for America on the July 4th, and to show that he's in shape and to go viral.
And it did, you know, and we're actually helping him do that, which I feel bad about.
It's just fun. Look, got to give him credit. It's funny to have a supposedly important, serious billionaire person doing something that's ridiculous.
Right.
Yeah. So that's my question, is like, how many billions of or millions of dollars do you have before people start? Before people
right. It's like, yeah, it's like, when are you eccentric versus crazy? It's a similar thing with that.
Like, I think if he had just $8 million, probably somebody would be, well, first of all, no one would care.
Who's worse? I mean, Bezos, like, would you rather he do this, or which is better, or which is worse? Zucker on an electric surfboard or Bezos going to space?
I think this is funny, personally.
Right.
Bezos going to space is like, I think all those guys are just, they're just in a giant measuring contest, you know? People could actually die, you know, with this space race, billionaire space race.
I mean, you could kill someone with that too.
With the surfboard?
Yeah, you never know. Anyway, it's just totally bizarre. And then there's some response videos to this, which are pretty good.
There is a creature alive today who has survived millions of years of evolution without change, without passion, and without logic. It lives to kill. A mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him jaws.
He's got lifeless eyes. Black eye, like a doll's eye. When he comes at you, he doesn't seem to be living until he bites you. And those black eyes roll over white, and then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and in spite of all the pounding and the hollering, they're coming at repeated pieces.
What I was kind of hoping is that the animal would come out of the water and
do that to him. It would have been good anti-sharkaganda too. Wilson, I did a little bit of I just literally went through his Instagram feed.
Send it.
Okay, so what he's like, just the biggest nerd ever.
Yeah.
And he's playing it to the Mayor Pete song. I'm almost impressed that he's showing this about himself, because he's so nerdy. Okay, if we could just watch him and how incredibly awkward he is. Okay.
Hey, everyone. It's good to see you. Let's just go ahead and get Adam Mosseri here.
All right, let's see. Who is his press guy? It's kind of encouraging. It's like billionaires, they're just like us. Tech problems, really awkward on camera.
It works.
Delays.
There you are.
I was worried if it didn't work, I was gonna get in trouble.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's tough. It's tough when you're running Instagram and if the live thing doesn't work. But no, I'm excited about a lot of the stuff that we're building. You know, a lot of the stuff that we're doing in Instagram. I'm excited to talk about that. How's the family?
Family's good. Look, the boys are nuts. We've got three of them, which is a lot.
Matt, like you, three of them.
But I don't know. The little one's the easy one, which is surprising. How are the girls?
They're good. We got to get the kids together again sometime. I know. Our especially Augie, my youngest, really, really has a thing for I think she and the Mosseri boy clan get along pretty well. It's pretty fun to see them together.
Yeah, well, I think the Mosseri boys have a thing for Augie. She like, they don't listen to anything I say ever, and when we hang out with Augie, Augie just directs them like she's like the conductor of the entire.
He's looking off to the side to make sure the person he kidnapped didn't escape.
I know, yeah. What's going on. Or Augie isn't there.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, she's got a charisma. I'm not sure where she got that.
Yeah,
from.
This guy's.
not me, but
he monopolized basically all human communication almost single-handedly suffocated the First Amendment. Well, I think it's I mean, it's so funny that he created Facebook because he had like resentments about girls and everything.
Yeah.
The rest of the world has to suffer. But that's probably the plot of about 90% of world disasters. Dudes who are frustrated.
Yeah.
Didn't get enough. Like
positive reinforcement, we'll say.
Positive reinforcement, let's put it that way. I don't know. The flag thing, the surfing on 4th of July thing, it's silly, but I think I'm for silly when it comes to billionaires.
You don't, I mean, okay, you know more than anyone else, though, why Facebook is terrible. So can you just fill it in?
It's like the real reason. One of a handful of companies that controls basically the vast majority of all news distribution. So if they decide, which they have been, to crack down on certain kinds of expression, then they can kind of single-handedly affect how whole populations consume news. So you see the relationship, the worst, biggest downside possible in situations like Israel, where they just regularly zap thousands of accounts created by Palestinian people, mainly because one of the reasons that Facebook is so effective as a means of communication that people use it basically as their only way of communicating with each other. Like, it's in a lot of places, it's like replaced the telephone, newspapers, everything. So it's become this choke point for speech. And in addition to the fact that they make more money than you could make if you like filled the whole warehouse full of $100 bill printing machines, like they've so completely perfected the science of collecting information about your surfing habits,
growing like a breeze,
and matching that to advertising, that they've created a basically unstoppable force, right, when it comes to making money on that scale. But
Right. The
really scary thing is the speech thing, because they for a long time he had this posture that he didn't want to get involved with moderating content. And after 2016, he went kind of sharply in the other direction. And now, you know, he's one of three or four companies that basically makes decisions about what people get to see about things, you know, whether it's COVID information or, you know, election information, you know, things like the Hunter Biden laptop story, which I know a lot of people don't think is important,
right.
But it's the idea that they're picking sides in political disputes now is kind of scary.
Also, I mean, we've said this before, right? But like, if Mark Zuckerberg is this guy who's responsible for Trump, why, and has the poor judgment, right, to like allow the Russians to do ABC, XYZ, whatever like the narrative is, like, why do you want him in charge of content moderation? Like, I thought he was a bad guy and craven. I mean, I think he is those things, but not because of I don't really think the Russia thing is an example of that. But it's just like, pick a narrative.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, now you scared him into being a good person.
And we talked about this with Matt Stoller, because the issue is, if you really believe people like Zuckerberg are dangerous, then you want to use antitrust laws to break up companies like this. Because the root problem is they just have too big of a share of things like media advertising and media distribution and all that stuff. They're just, the company's too big. But rather than make the company smaller and enforce antitrust provisions, what all these critics of Facebook have decided to do is sort of leave them in place and basically just ask them to crack down on a different group of people. In other words, rather than using Facebook as the Trump campaign did in 2016, they were really, really effective with Facebook ads. That's one of the reasons they won. You know, allegedly, right, there was the Russian influence on. So, but rather than just split up Facebook so that it couldn't conceivably do that much damage, what they did is drag them into Washington and say, like, we want you to now get involved with being the editor in chief of the universe, which he's totally unqualified to do.
And we want to give a shout out and wish well to Mark Zuckerberg and all the other tech bosses who are at summer camp for billionaires right now. They're in rural Idaho. I guess they do this retreat there. It's called the Sun Valley Conference.
Mm.
And Apple's Tim Cook, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, Netflix's Reed Hastings, and Ted Sarandos, plus Airbnb's Brian Chesky. They're all hanging out.
That sounds fantastic.
It's organized by, I know, the investment firm Allen & Company. Do you know about this?
No.
Brings together people from tech, media, design, and sports, and it's been taking place every year since July 1983, except for 2020 because of the COVID pandemic. What do you think it would be like hanging out with all these people? You think they're all as awkward as he is?
It could be anything from deadly boring to like human sacrifice and orgies. Right. We wouldn't know the difference.
Yeah.
All right. So that was the four food groups.
So we're so excited to have on the show Adolph Reed, who is a political scientist. He's a professor emeritus at Penn. He's written several books, including The South, Jim Crow and Its Afterlives, which is not published yet. That is a preview. We're just announcing it. That is not yet in existence. This is a pattern. We did this with Norm Finkelstein. We tell you about books coming out that aren't out yet. But he's
we've
already
read them. You don't get to, or we know about them.
We know. Well, we know about them. We read them. In the case of Finkelstein's, we're going to get reads and rub it in your faces. And then hopefully you'll rub it in your literal faces when you buy it. He's the author of books, including Crashing the Party, From the Bernie Sanders Campaign to a Progressive Movement, Renewing Black Intellectual History, The Ideological and Material Foundations of African-American Thought, Without Justice for All, The New Liberalism and Our Retreat from Racial Equality. He's very prolific. He runs nonsite.org, which is a great website. And he got
into a kerfuffle recently, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to have him talk about the subject of this new book by Robin
with
DiAngelo.
Whom did he get into a kerfuffle?
The Democratic Socialists.
Oh, a while ago. Yeah. He was almost, he was uninvited because he's a class reductionist. And I just want to say something before we launch.
And a critic of race reductionism, which is essentially what this book is about. The Robin DiAngelo book is about. Yeah. So.
And I just want to say, like, you know, it's not just, and I don't want to sound corny, especially because we're talking about Robin DiAngelo, who is so cringe, but like, it's not just that people like DiAngelo de-emphasize class. It's that she actually puts forward programs and trainings that stand in the way of class programs that actually disproportionately benefit Black people and people of color. So it's not just a question. I think lots of times people think like, oh, we care about universal rights. We want everyone to have healthcare. Like we do. We do want everyone to have healthcare. But if you care about people of color and you care about racism, it's not sufficient, but it's necessary to adopt universal programs.
I think it's worse than that, actually. I think her whole ideology is about heightening the importance of racial identity. So even though she's superficially campaigning against racism, what she's arguing for is this idea that everybody should be more racially conscious all the time, which as I've made this argument before, it's essentially the same argument as people like Richard Spencer and David Duke and people like that. And it's one of the reasons why her passages in her books are often sound strikingly like what those people say. So it'll be interesting to talk to Professor Reed about this because he has a lot of ideas on the subject, and he's been very vociferous about a lot of these issues. So, all right. So without further ado, let's talk to Professor Adolph Reed.
Yeah. Well, before we jump into it, can I just ask you a question, which is probably overwhelming, and you can also pass on it and we can get back right into the DiAngelo thing. But what is how do you define racism?
Oh, yeah, that's a question. Well, I think it's fundamentally an ideology, right? I mean, if you want to be literal about it, and, you know, as an historian of ideologies, that's kind of what my shtick is. It's like an attitude, or it's a set of attitudes. I sometimes go back and forth on this, right? So the real thing to me, right, is that hierarchical societies, right, of probably any sort, but the ones that we know most intimately are capitalist ones or feudalist ones, whatever. But hierarchical societies don't depend just on force and coercion to stabilize the dominance of the ruling class. They depend on ideologies. And one of the key kinds of ideologies that they depend on is what my friend and colleague at two different places, Roger Smith, initially referred to as ideologies of ascriptive difference, that is, difference based on what you supposedly are instead of what you do. And what those ideologies do is provide a natural seeming justification for why everybody is where they are at the moment in the society. So I tend to think of the genus, right, if I can get Darwinian for a second, as the ideologies of ascriptive difference. And race as a species, along with other species that are part of that or that constitute that genus, gender, sexual orientation, natural origin, right, by country or whatever. And they vary over time as they would have to, right, to serve the needs of the moment. Or really, to be less functionalist about it, to create the common sense understanding of the moment, right? And what that means, among other things, is that they work best when they are assumed to come out of nature, so people don't have to think about them or to justify them, right? Well, he's a slave, he's Black. Yeah, well, that makes sense then, because Blacks are supposed to be slaves after a certain point, right? Not for time immemorial, as the Afro-pessimists or Nicole Hannah Jones would argue, right? So all these notions exist within history, all these ideologies exist within history. One of the interesting things I think that we've experienced over the last half century or so, and there are reasons for this too, we'll get into, that racism as a category has expanded, right? The currency of what counts as racism has inflated, like the Deutschmark in the late 1920s, right? So like anything can be racist, and racism becomes the sole explanation or sole explanatory category for making sense of any kind of inequality or seemingly inappropriate or unjustifiable inequality that involves Black people or other non-whites, like in any way. So for instance, like a grad student advisee of mine, who actually you and I have a shared link to, and I hope she doesn't start getting embarrassed about my doing this, but in her first year, in the PhD program, she was in my grad seminar on Black American political thought. And she was leading discussions around a mass of readings between the mid-30s and end of the 40s. And it was all kind of new stuff to her, but her first comment was that she was surprised genuinely to see that nobody that she read talked about struggling against racism, right? That everybody talked about much more concrete stuff, programs that they were for, programs that they were against, policies they were for, policies they were against. And I said, yeah, well, that didn't happen until after the victories of the social movements of the 60s. So then, and I mean, Lord knows, this is what post-war racial liberalism in the US was all about. So you struggle against racism, which is like part of the struggle against prejudice, part of the struggle against intolerance, bigotry, and so forth and so on. What recedes from view is like essential problems of economic inequality, like employment inequality, housing inequality, et cetera, et cetera. So, but I mean, like I said, that's possibly why that's happened is possibly another conversation. But anyway, so once again, Katie, you've asked me what time it is, and I've given you a disquisition on how to make a watch.
Well, I mean, I asked you what time is, I think, would be the analogy. Okay. Yeah.
Fair enough. So, I appreciate it.
Yes. Thank you. Really appreciate your answer.
Well, in the framework of all of this, obviously we just had Robin DiAngelo just had her new book come out, Nice Racism. Right. In the framework of that kind of progression of how we understand what social change is all about. Like once upon a time, it was about concrete policy changes, structural changes, and then it evolved after those 60s movements. Where does A, is this thing that DiAngelo is expressing, is it wholly new? And where does it fit in to what you're talking about,
right,
her point of view?
Yeah, well, it's not wholly new. Like I said, I mean, this is what my son brought home before the 70s were over, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the stuff has been out there. But I do want to say one thing in D'Angelo's favor, which is that, and this is in response to the appropriation thing. Technically, she wouldn't really have been white before 1924 anyway, or at least not before the New Deal. So, she's got some claim. But anyway, no, it's not new. I mean, I think combating racism becomes a convenient alternative to attacking inequality. Inequality, even like even those inequalities that appear or that manifest themselves as racial disparities, right? The struggle against racism is exactly parallel to the struggle against terrorism, right? It can go on forever because the enemy is an abstraction that you can define however you want to define it at the moment that you want to define it. Part of D'Angelo's thing, and she's not the first person to do this. I mean, there's this woman named Peggy McIntosh who, going back to the 70s, had like the knapsack of privilege or some kind of shit like that. And I know people, and there's something interesting here too, but I know people who have had careers at racial sensitivity trainings. And the people that I know, like in my world, the people who came out of the movement, actually came out of anti-Klan politics or like other kind of left politics in the 70s, and they started doing this stuff. It makes sense, like in the same way that, you know, people who were graduate students in the late 60s and early 70s who were left theory inclined people, you know, got into the Frankfurt School or Althusser, and that became the cornerstone of their academic careers. Well, that's what's happened in the anti-racism or the racial sensitivity training world. And one of the things that's happened over time is that the material incentives, and see, it's funny, pardon this aside, but it's funny, like how many political economy oriented leftists we encounter who apply critical political economic thinking to every domain in the world outside the movement that they're operating in.
Right.
But so the material incentives evolved and changed over time. And like some of my friends who have done this work have said to me that they used to do it for community groups, used to do it for unions and so forth and so on. Then as the material incentives changed, they wound up doing it more for corporations or for local governments who are under consent decrees. So this becomes part of the thing, right? Like you're under a consent decree for actual discrimination. One of the remedies that's likely to be imposed as part of the dissent decree is that you submit to this kind of training, and we see it all the time now too, right? Like even the insurgencies within NGOs, right, where staff or whatever start going batshit crazy about how the leadership of the organization is all racist, sexist, whatever, right? And one of the first calls is to bring in some, you know, minor league version of Robin DiAngelo to do the racial sensitivity training. So in that sense, it's taken hold as part of what I've often described as a broader political economy of race relations. Okay, so I think that's partly the way we need to understand this. Since all of it, right, is, again, I'm trying to find a not too functionalist seeming way to put this, but maybe I'll just live with it for now. But since all of this complex, right, both the discursive and institutional, have emerged around a systemic disposition to find ways to evade talking about class and economic inequality, then it just grows in that, you know, sort of dark environment with other fungi and so forth and so on.
It could be a good jumping off point to watch a clip of an interview that she did on MSNBC. There's going to be a lot of, I think, food for thought, and it features our good friend Al Sharpton.
Ah, okay. Well, wait. I need to check my credit cards because he could probably find a way to get to him through the video clip.
Seriously. This either or, right? You're either racist or you're not right. Racist, and in a moment such as we have now, both forces, if you will, both sides are amplified. And so it's very easy for those of us who are deeply committed to racial justice to see ourselves as on the not racist side. And we can point to the really explicit, clear, extreme examples, but it's much harder to get your hands on the more implicit, the well-intended, unaware, but still, you know, impactful ways that folks like me, well-meaning, well-intended folks, collude with the system. It is not an aberration. Racism is not an aberration. It is the norm. And so if we are passive within that norm, if we see ourselves as not part of the problem, we will inadvertently contribute to it by our passivity. So outwoking is this what I call a move to always position oneself as more aware, more advanced than other people. It's the pointing the finger outward rather than inward.
Dr. DeAngelo, one of the things that appealed to me about your new book is talking about trying to outwoke others. And I see that all the time in a lot of movement engagement that I'm involved in, where people tend to trivialize legitimate struggle of blacks and gays and Latino X and all Latinx or whoever by dealing with what is trendy that makes them look woke rather than dealing with the real problem. How do you deal with this in the book and what made you go there, if I could put it that way?
Certainly, and it is an honor to be speaking with you, Reverend Sharpton.
Honor's
thank you.
Mine.
That's a sinister little laugh
there.
Yeah.
Move where you position yourself above other people as more advanced, and it is a very superficial response. Last summer you saw much more involvement from what we might call the average white person. You saw protests, you saw activism. But in some ways, it's somewhat exciting and interesting to go down to a protest. The daily, day in and day out struggle, the courage that it takes to get racism on the table and keep it on the table, the humility that is required for white people, that is much harder. And we see that fade out. We don't always see the excitement sustained when it comes down to the really difficult work. And the concept of white fragility resonated so deeply with so many people worldwide that I wanted to keep going with that, to go deeper and help unpack. So what does this look like in our daily
translation,
lives?
She wanted to sell another
book. I make a provocative claim in white fragility that white progressives, those of us who see ourselves on that progressive side of that equation, actually cause the most daily harm.
That's a line in her book that I missed originally, and then I went back. She says this: I believe that white progressives cause the most daily damage to people of color. And I tripped over that at first, but then I wondered, I mean, clearly the book is aimed at that audience.
Right.
So is that just about trying to play on the emotions of those readers, or does she really believe that? Or what is she trying to say with that line, do you think?
Well, you know, I might have said this on a podcast with you guys before, and if I did, I apologize, but it's worth saying again anyway. My father used to describe ideology as, in one sense, being the mechanism that harmonizes the principles that you want to believe you hold with what advances your material interest. Right? So in that sense, like the question kind of misses, your question kind of misses the point. So when I heard her then, like what I imagine was like J.K. Rowling, is that her name? Explaining how she felt after the first Harry Potter book was a success. And it's like, yeah, I mean, like you said, Matt, so like I'm onto something. I made a lot of money here. And yeah. I think I can keep this thing going for about 12 other iterations, right? But the other thing I thought was just in listening to her, I mean, the image that came to my mind was Viola Liuzzo, right? The postal worker or wife of a postal worker who from Detroit, who went down to Selma in 1965 to participate in the Voting Rights March and to participate like in organizing the Voting Rights March. And she was killed, right, by the Klan. And I thought, oh, so that's what she was doing down there, really. She was just trying to out-woke the Black people.
Right.
I mean, I mean, I don't even know what to say to shit like that. I really don't. I mean, it's just pretty repugnant.
Yeah, I mean, to the question of they do the most racial harm of all. Like, she provides no proof of that at all. Right. No. And I think obviously there's self-interest there, but I think she's maybe like to be charitable, though she doesn't really deserve it because she's totally disingenuous, I would say. But let's read her as not, like, let's read her as right. as naive. I think maybe she's confusing how ironic it is with it being the most of something. So mm-hmm. it's maybe more ironic right. when yeah. progressives engage in racist behavior or have racist ideas, and it may stand out more. I mean, I think that's like the only thing that she remotely proves, but yeah.
I think she's trying to say that by covering up, by giving sort of latent racism the veneer of respectability, yeah. that it causes more damage than right. the open version. So she's right. she's essentially, I mean, her whole book is arguing against this idea of suppressing the hidden ugliness. And she's just, I think what she's saying is that the people who are sort of hiding it effectively are more dangerous than the people who who aren't. But yeah. I don't know that that's true. I mean, it's yeah. it feels more like something you might convince yourself if you lived in right. the suburbs. But I don't know.
It also kind of reminds me of people. I don't hear much of this anymore, but you still hear some here and there who would say, "Well, I prefer the upfront, out and open racism of the Jim Crow South to the genteel, submerged racism of the suburban North." Well, in the first place, it was overdrawn, right? As my forthcoming book will illuminate.
Oh, you got to plug it. What's it called?
Well, I think Verso's calling it now The South, with the subtitle Jim Crow and Its Afterlives, and it should be out around the end of the year. It's a non-memoir or an anti-memoir. But anyway, but as someone who has experienced ample quantities of both, the view that the out front is better to deal with, or one would prefer to deal with it, just strikes me as a view that can be held only by people who haven't ever had to deal with the out front on a regular basis, right? Mm-hmm. And again, like, I mean, to Lyndon Johnson on this, right? Like, the point, as he pointed out, that the point of the Civil Rights Bill of 1964 was not to change people's attitudes, it was to change their public behavior. And you got a right to have whatever fucked up attitude you have. You know, I mean, you guys, for instance, I'm not trying to flatter you just because I'm on, but I mean, you guys and other people who operate in this domain are going to be more instrumental in helping to change the terms of political debate. And that's one of the reasons we've decided to do a podcast on our own, as you know, Katie, and around that very theme, what would the country look like if we're governed by and in the interest of the working class? Right.
Yeah. This is a useful idiots exclusive breaking news, I think. Right. Have you announced this elsewhere? Yeah,
Nope, haven't. That's right.
So Adolf Reed and others are launching a podcast, tentatively or perhaps permanently, called Class Matters.
Right, correct. And we're hoping to get together for the launch around Labor Day weekend.
Wow, fantastic.
So, yeah, but this is the breaking news. Now, you got it first.
Yeah, we got to get the Chiron. Exactly, that's breaking news across the bottom.
Yeah.
Little crawl action going on. So that was great.
That was so great. He's great. Very funny.
Yeah, very
great
funny.
Sense of humor. Great turn of phrase. Yeah.
And that, you know, look, that whole thing about how essentially this is the same ideology as the kind of defeated Confederate intellectuals. I mean, I think that's right on the money. It's controversial. It'll probably get him in some hot water for saying that. But there's a lot to that, I think. You know, you see, essentially, this kind of stuff is designed to defuse any arguments that are made, like, from the direction of political economy, right?
Yeah, and another thing I wanted to just say quickly, on a related note, there's a lot of people of color who can't stand Robin DiAngelo. I've been getting some pushback about this, how it's problematic to criticize her. You can find yourself in many positions on the spectrum politically, and have real disdain for D'Angelo, anywhere from being more of a liberal progressive who has a problem with the way she commodifies, weaponizes benefits from the labor of people of color, to being more of an unrepentant leftist like myself, who doesn't appreciate how she undermines class mobilizing. So I just wanted to put that out there, because I feel like people have been doing some kind of like, what's the word? Monolithizing, it's not a word, but turning all people of color, much like Robin DiAngelo does, into this magical monolith that has one opinion.
Yeah, she's become like an icon of something, but
does this new intensified or resurgent form of racism that we see with Trump, does that require require confronting racism in a new way? I actually think kind of like what I mean, not surprisingly, I agree with Adolf, and I think it's the opposite. It's like, given that people are having their ethnic identity, their whiteness appealed to, pitched to, like, you have to say, no, you're being played. Like, all of that is to screw you over, divide and conquer. And, you know, I don't think it will work to tell, like, you know, the person who's, and even if you hate these people, again, you can think you can have whatever classist attitudes you want. I mean, I will have a problem with that, but it's a free country. Like, just don't you get on a strategic level and a tactical level how telling people who feel like they're losing their advantage, like that they need to check their privilege, that's not going to work?
Yeah, I mean, if you frame for people as a choice between white pride and white guilt, they're gonna choose white pride. Which you're not gonna like the answer there, you know, like,
right?
That's which is and crazy.
That, which doesn't mean that you're throwing that does not require or go hand in hand with throwing people of color under the bus. In fact, you can't go around saying that the world is that all white people are racist, and then say we want to empower people of color. White people need to empower people of color by pitching them anti-racism in the most unappealing way.
Right.
That just, which is your priority, like shaming people or actually fighting for things that, like making allies out of people and fighting for programs that actually disproportionately help people who you claim to care about or champion or represent.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, no, it doesn't make any sense if you think about it rationally, but they do it anyway. Yeah. The other thing is, you talk about how there are people of color who find her problematic.
Yeah.
Like, kind of not surprising. I mean, I have to say, I mean, you and I both grew up in kind of, you know, sort of privileged upper class, you know, backgrounds. I can't say that I have a ton of experience of being around people who are overtly racist, but you definitely every now and then will meet a person who's got like an unhealthy intensity about the subject, and it like sets off your spider sense. And, you know, you just kind of know to back away from that person. And she gives me that vibe. Right? I mean, don't you get that?
Like that she does some weird stuff like behind closed doors?
No, that she's just, that there's something about this person who's just like way too into the subject, like really, really unhealthily interested in things like stereotypes about.
Oh, I see.
You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, they might couch it as intellectual curiosity or something like that, but there's something like weird there.
Yeah.
And like, and there's a scene in the book where she says, one of the most important ways that I have worked to challenge my racial socialization has been to build authentic cross-racial relationships. Yet I still perpetrate harm on occasion in those relationships as a result of the unavoidable reality that I was raised in a white supremacist culture. Like, first of all, what must those friendships be like?
Oh my God, so draining.
Can you imagine?
If I were on the other end of that, I would just put my phone down and like mop the floor.
Right, right.
I'm sure she doesn't require any intervention. Yeah.
Just even imagining what those interactions must be like, it just makes you want to curl up in a ball, and it's just total cringe. But
you wrote a good piece on your Substack. Can you just give a quick summary of the dinner that inspired
the
title of your piece?
She opens her book. This is an amazing thing. She opens the book giving this description. I might as well just read from her thing, because it's so
funny.
She tells a story at the beginning of the book where she and this is the first two paragraphs. She is in college. She goes out to dinner with a friend.
With her then girlfriend. Which is relevant. Her romantic partner.
Goes into the restaurant and is shocked to find out that the other couple is Black. And she writes, "I was excited and felt an immediate need to let them know I was not racist. I proceeded to spend the evening telling them how racist my family was. I shared every racist joke, story, and comment I could remember my family ever making." And she says, she realizes that this made the couple uncomfortable, but she goes on, "I obliviously plowed ahead, ignoring their signals. I was having a great time regaling them with these anecdotes, the proverbial life of the party. My progressive credentials were impeccable. I was a minority myself, a woman in a committed relationship with another woman. I knew how to talk about patriarchy and heterosexism. I was a cool white progressive, not an ignorant racist. Of course, what I was actually demonstrating was how completely oblivious I was."
And yes, I shared these in full, uncensored. Can you believe they said that, I would ask? So can you imagine sitting at this dinner, having a woman being like, and then the Black guy walks into a restaurant and says, but like just reciting racist jokes and then saying, can you believe that?
I know. And when she,
it's like an SNL sketch.
And she's talking about how she's having fun regaling him with these stories, which is like, sorry, even that, it's just so fucked up.
Yeah,
right?
Who does that?
You know, like in even if you, I don't know, thought you were trying to make a connection by,
right.
You would maybe couch it as, and I felt so bad, you know, right. Because it, like you wouldn't be like, and then they said, this,
yeah, that is know? The weirdest thing.
Like, right.
Like I get the, even that, you know, that other racism she perpetuated, which I do think is a little like where she makes a joke about someone responding to a Black woman's braids and then she had to repair that. Like that, I would never do that. But I get where it comes from. It's like actually what she calls it is credentializing, which I get it. You're trying to show that you're down. But this is the opposite of that, or woke or whatever. This is the opposite. It's like, let me tell you about how racist my parents are by sharing some great jokes they used to tell around that house. Can you believe it?
Right. Yeah. And let me scan your faces while I tell you these stories about their offensive comments or whatever. Yeah. Right. Like, it's just creepy. I don't think.
Can you imagine that dinner? Like, yeah. What kind of, I mean, I do really think she's a narcissist because she gets so angry at people who don't like her tunings. Yeah. And she talks about how they need humility. It's like, okay, lady, you keep talking about this person not liking your thing, that person walking out. Maybe you're showing instead of telling, because there's a real gaping, there's like a humility void in this white person being Rahm DeAngelo.
Oh, I know. I mean, the book is full of like unintentional comedy because she'll go off in these stories about how so-and-so doesn't want to listen to her teaching. And then she'll proceed to retell the story and explain the 19 different ways that they are wrong.
Yeah.
And then the punchline of that will be, and they still didn't listen, you know, and then there will be like a headline why can't Bob and Sue hear me? Right. And it's totally excluded that they just think you're insane.
Right.
And the only possible explanation can be that they're in denial about their racism.
Yeah. And it's major gaslighting also, because it's saying like, if you, there are two choices, right? And actually this comes from an article in the Washington Post. Carlos Losado said this, I'm paraphrasing, but basically you have two choices. One is that you acknowledge that Robin DiAngelo is right and you are indeed a racist, or you say you're not and you are indeed fulfilling her prophecy or for showing her to be right. Because you are white you have white fragility, which is what stops you from acknowledging what she's saying.
Right. It's the ordeal by water, Kafka trap, whatever you want to call it. Right. You can't. It's a no win situation. Which is, it's on one level, it's brilliant. I mean, I think she's it's a crude money making scheme, but it's very very effective. You know, and I think. One of the things that's hilarious about this book is that just that whole thing about how if you don't agree with me, you're a racist. That's so powerful that you don't even have to like write a good book. You can write a completely shitty book and people will still buy it.
And then write it again.
And write it again. Yeah. So it's kind of amazing, but
it really is amazing.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. Anyway, great to talk to Professor Reed again. Yeah. I'm sorry we didn't get to talk more basketball with him, but
I know you're sorry. I mean, I can't even tell you about how many questions I had him about Giannis. Make sure that you subscribe to us on Substack. That is usefulidiots.substack.com. Also subscribe to us on YouTube. That is youtube.com/usefulidiots. Rate and review us on iTunes. Subscribe wherever you find your podcast. So that's iTunes, that's Stitcher. What's the one that I never, Spotify. Yeah, just look around town and you'll find it there. You're definitely going to want to become Substack supporters because if you do that, you will get to hear some really hot takes from Adolf Reed. Spicy hot takes that you can only hear and see at usefulidiots.substack.com. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. That's Useful Idiot. So just singular, Useful Idiot Pod. And make sure you check us out on Substack and on Twitter. We will be releasing yet another crossword.
The Bigger Pockets portfolio of podcasts are worthy of your investment.
We're having a real conversation as real estate investors.
New episodes available every day.
It's important to buy where it makes money and not necessarily where you want to travel to.
Bigger Pockets, On the Market, Rookie Real Estate, or Money Podcast.
The purpose of flipping is to create more cash so then you can reinvest into other types of properties.
The Bigger Pockets podcast on YouTube or wherever you listen.